The State Board of Education has appointed a new executive director, even though the state superintendent doesn't think it has the power to do so. So how will the two work together?
She did shake my hand after the meeting and welcome me on board, and I think that's a good start, and I hope more conversations and collaboration will follow.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, observing the 25th anniversary of Arizona's Victims' Bill of Rights. How much is too much when it comes to standardized testing? On the trail of the right dog to help police, and taking a stroll with a purpose.
Political protests, marches, walking, that is all walking. Socioeconomically, who has to walk?
Plus, cooking for cancer patients, and Scottsdale tries to conjure the jazz age. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Quick check of Valley traffic. I-17 southbound. A collision at Bethany Home blocks the intersection there. Also on the 101 northbound in the East Valley, the center lane at Thomas is blocked. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon today with a high of 75. Clear tonight, overnight lows near 50. Then a sunny, warmer weekend with highs both tomorrow and Sunday right around 80 degrees. It's 67 degrees under sunny skies right now at KJZZ. ASU police officers have started wearing body cameras. As KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports, the officers spent the last 3 weeks learning how to use the equipment, which they hope will improve transparency and build trust within the community.
ASU police officers have joined the ranks of law enforcement across the state who wear body cameras when out in the field. Chief Michael Thompson says 80 cameras have been deployed at a cost of $400 apiece, which the university paid for. As for when those cameras go on,
they are turned on when we respond to any calls for service, or if we are making a traffic stop or some kind of citizen contact where we feel that it could develop into some type of call or we need to take a report.
Besides learning how to operate the camera, Chief Thompson says part of the training involves studying the department's policy on body cameras. The policy, which Thompson describes as comprehensive, was put together using policies from agencies across the state and country. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Arizona Board of Education this week appointed a new executive director. Carol Schmidt currently serves as director of academic programs at Grand Canyon University and will take over at the state board on November 30th. State school superintendent Diane Douglas tried to fire Schmidt's soon-to-be predecessor before Governor Doug Ducey stepped in. The state education department and Board of Education are currently engaged in multiple lawsuits. Carol Schmidt joins me. And Carol, what drew you to this job with all of its political controversies?
I think anyone in education wants to make a difference. I think this was an opportunity to make a difference in a different way, really capitalizing and using all of my skill sets. There's been some important policy initiatives before the board, and the superintendent has also laid out a plan that has a tremendous amount of policy implications. So having worked in the area of teacher education and teaching school law, I've been an observer of education policy over the years, and there's a lot of interesting things going on with that right now, and the timing felt really right to get involved.
Did the controversies going on with the board and the Department of Education give you any kind of pause?
Not really. I've been advised of the situation. I've been following the news, too, and we talked about that during the interview process. I think that will all get resolved at some point between the courts or the legislature if they take action. So I think the thing is to keep moving forward and working towards making a difference.
One of the big issues that the board has been dealing with and one of the main controversies between the board and the Department of Education is the Common Core standards, or the College and Career Ready standards, as they're called here in Arizona. Where do you fall on what the state should be doing as far as standards for math and English and how the state should be developing them?
The governor spoke to the board about a revision process that's underway right now, and that revision process allows for a tremendous amount of public comment. Public hearings are being held throughout the state, and they can also submit comments to the state board's website.
Do you think that the standards need big revisions or like minor tweaks or something else?
I think that's something that's going to come from the field. We have teachers that have been working with the standards now for a few years, so I think we hope that there'll be a great deal of input from them weighing in on the revisions and that they'd like to see.
How do you envision your working relationship with the State Department of Education and the current Superintendent of Public Instruction? That's obviously been an issue with your soon-to-be predecessor. How do you think your relationship will go?
I hope with what's going on right now with the standards revision process, I think there's a great momentum right now for collaboration. I want to acknowledge the efforts of the governor's office in setting up these public hearings throughout the state and the work of county officials on that. There's great collaboration then with the department on vetting those. So I hope to build on that momentum and continue that positive collaboration.
You mentioned that you've been following the news. It would be impossible, I think, for somebody in your position not to. You are somebody that the superintendent, in theory, doesn't want to have this job. I mean, does that is that a concern for you?
No, I think I reviewed Judge Starr's ruling. That issue is now with the Court of Appeals in terms of the hiring powers of the board. But Judge Starr made clear that the board had that authority and the superintendent is a member of the board. She did shake my hand after the meeting and welcome me on board. And I think that's a good start. And I hope more conversations and collaboration will follow.
Do you think that the state is on a good path as far as the standardized test that it selected to go with basically the Common Core standards, the AZ Merit test? Is that a good test in your mind?
The first sets of results will be coming out, and I think in connection with that and the revision process, there's likely to be further discussion about the test. The superintendent's also, in her plan, put forth an idea about looking at that in connection with some formative options. And what I mean by formative is that you evaluate students along the way. So that gives more opportunities for the teachers to take different instructional approaches, reteach, address the students' needs as the school year goes on.
Carol Schmidt will take over as Executive Director of the Arizona Board of Education on November 30th. Carol, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Twenty-five years ago today, Arizona voters decided to amend the state constitution to include a victim's bill of rights. It includes the rights to be present at any proceeding at which the defendant is present and to be notified when the accused has been released from custody, among others. Phoenix attorney Steve Twist drafted the amendment and joins me. So, Steve, has the victim's bill of rights done what you hoped it would 25 years ago?
Yes and no. We all had high hopes that the constitutional amendment that passed in 1990 would change the criminal justice system to make it more fair and more respectful of the role of victims. And a lot of progress has been made, but there are areas where we still see challenges.
Like what?
Well, you know, if you think about it, defendants' rights were in the U.S. Constitution for decades throughout the history of our country before they became change agents of the culture of the criminal justice system. Now, a lot of people can debate and still do debate whether or not the court went far enough in protecting the rights of the defendants or went too far in protecting the rights of the defendants, but there's no debate about what the agent of change was, and that was lawyers who litigated cases trying to give life to the rights in the Constitution. Some of our efforts have been extremely successful. Victims are no longer subject to pretrial interrogations at the hand of the person who assaulted them or who victimized them. That was a hideous practice that went on in Arizona prior to the constitutional amendment, and it was stopped when the amendment passed. But some of the promises that the people of Arizona made through the Constitution to crime victims remain unfulfilled, like, for example, the right to a speedy trial. There are still homicide cases in Arizona where from the date of arrest until the date of trial, it's taken 7 or 8 years. So there are some examples like that where we still have to have a more robust effort to try to enforce the rights.
Since Arizona voters approved the constitutional amendment to put the victim's Bill of Rights in the state constitution, many, many other states have done it. In fact, the majority of states in the country now have something along the lines of what Arizona has. Do you think sort of the tide has turned now as far as not just protecting the rights of defendants, but also victims sort of across the country?
Well, thank you for pointing that out. I think we were fourth or fifth in the nation, and now there are 33 states that have state constitutional amendments for victims' rights, and I'm privileged to be able to say that many of those states followed Arizona's language. It does show the widespread support for balancing the scales of justice, but ultimately what the goal is what Ronald Reagan proposed in 1982, and that's that the federal constitution be amended to include rights for crime victims. It hasn't gotten enough votes yet to be referred to the states, but I think it's inevitable. Ultimately, the rights that we're talking about in Arizona, that Arizonans have enjoyed for 25 years, some with more effect than others, but that we've enjoyed for 25 years, ought to be the birthright of every person who is in the United States and who is unfortunately the victim of a crime.
In your mind, in Arizona, are the scales of justice balanced in terms of protecting the constitutional rights of defendants, but also protecting the state constitutional rights of victims?
Yeah, in no case has the court concluded that a defendant's rights have been infringed by a fair application of the victim's Bill of Rights. No case has been overturned because the victim had a right to be in the courtroom or a right to be heard at a critical stage or a right to present, you know, views at sentencing or anything like that. So these rights are not rights that really infringe on the rights of defendants, but they simply add to the rights that all of us enjoy as citizens, whether we're a defendant or whether we're a victim of crime.
Steve Twist is a Phoenix attorney. He was also one of the people behind the 1990 effort to get Arizona voters to amend the state constitution with the Victims' Bill of Rights. Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The city of Scottsdale is hosting a first-of-its-kind event this weekend, and organizers say it's more than just a race.
It's absolutely art, way beyond many racers. They're true pieces of art that will be proudly displayed, and heck, these things are museum pieces as far as I'm concerned.
How the streets of downtown Scottsdale are being transformed into Monaco for a day, that's just ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on 91.5 KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, 101 northbound, three lanes are blocked at Thomas. You'll definitely want to avoid that area if you can. Again, the 101 northbound in the East Valley at Thomas, three lanes blocked there. Elsewhere, I-17 southbound, a crash blocks the intersection at Bethany Home. Look for mostly sunny skies for the rest of the day today with a high of 75. Clear tonight, overnight lows near 50. Sunny and warmer for tomorrow with a high of 80. More of the same for Sunday and Monday as well. Right now in Phoenix, under sunny skies, it's 70 degrees at KJZZ at 217.
KJZZ is supported by Citizens Clean Elections Commission, helping to take the guesswork out of voting. You can pledge to vote informed for the 2016 elections on the issues that matter most to you. Details at facebook.com/azcleanelections.
President Obama recently called for a cap on standardized testing, saying students shouldn't spend more than 2% of their time in the classroom taking such tests. How significant of a reduction would that be? To find out, we turn to Audrey Amrine Beardsley, an associate professor in the Mary Lou Fulton Teachers College at ASU. She's been studying standardized testing for nearly two decades. And Audrey, do American students spend too much time on standardized tests?
We do way too much testing across the nation, and so that's the interesting thing about this report. The tenets of the report is that we're going to reduce standardized testing as a nation, but when you actually get into the report, you find that they're reducing a current average of 2.34% of every child's school days down to 2%. And so what that translates into is about 20 to 25 hours of testing time only every year for every child, which translates to about 4 days of concentrated test timing that does not include test preparation, test rehearsal, test coaching, it just includes concentrated seat time taking tests. So the headline that says the federal government's intent on reducing standardized testing, it's really not a reduction that I think that we, as a general public and also parents of children and people that are generally interested in public education, would want to see.
Is there a role for standardized testing? I mean, should there be some of it done?
There should be some of it done. There's a rule of thumb that a lot of us who are, you know, study tests for a career site, and that is that the farther the test gets away from the classroom, the worse the test gets. We trust teachers to assess their students on, for example, something that they might have taught for 1 month. That's a very instructionally relevant and an instructionally sensitive test. So that, by all means, is very instructionally useful for teachers. But the farther that you get away from the teacher or from the classroom, the worse the test gets.
Is that where you get into the problem of teachers teaching to the test?
You get into the problem of teachers teaching through the test and other things that are similar, like the narrowing of the curriculum when math tests might matter more than we possibly marginalize science. That happens when high stakes or consequential decisions are attached to tests.
So in your mind, what are the appropriate uses for standardized tests, and what should students take those tests for?
Students should take those tests as long as they're closely aligned to instruction and they're instructionally relevant and instructionally sensitive, so that teachers can actually use the data as actionable indicators that they can improve upon their practice. And there's a national test that's also very important to note here, which is called the National Assessment of Educational Progress.
The NAEP test.
The NAEP test, exactly. And so that's a wonderful test because, number one, there are not any consequences attached to that test. So it's a really accurate and reliable and also a valid indicator of what's happening across the nation. And so most testing experts agree that that's the nation's best test.
If students aren't going to take as many standardized tests and spend as much time taking them as they have been, what are the ways that we can really compare students and how they're learning and how much they're learning? It just seems like there are so many variables from classroom to classroom, much less from school to school, district to district, state to state.
So the default solution to that, when people ask about those questions in terms of, let's just say, inter-school comparisons, are the standardized tests that we use right now in terms of the state level tests. And so we can use that test and it's called disaggregating the data, and we can compare schools against schools and districts against districts. But the problem with that approach is that there are multiple problems with that approach, one of which is that the demographics of the schools are extremely highly correlated with test scores, to the point that I, as a statistician, if I had maybe 3 or 4 external variables that I threw into a model, I could predict the test scores without the test scores even ever taking place.
Wow.
Right. So we say that we need the test, but really we don't, because we can predict it with about 80%, 80 to 85% accuracy without the tests in place anyways. They're very, very sensitive to the types of students and the types of communities in which these schools are located.
Audrey Amrine Beardsley is an associate professor in the Mary Lou Fulton Teachers College at ASU and has been studying standardized testing for nearly 20 years. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, along with the Takeaways' Tons Willick today. The Peanuts Gang hits the big screen for its first feature-length film this weekend, introducing a whole new generation to Snoopy and Charlie Brown, Linus, Lucy, Sally, Pigpen, and the whole gang. Now, you might have grown up reading Charlie Brown in an actual paper over breakfast in the morning. Or if not, maybe you can find your Peanuts consumption to Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas with holiday specials on TV.
But Peanuts introduced memes before memes were really an intentional thing in popular culture. Think of Snoopy dancing with his nose in the air, Linus holding that blanket. But the one that stands out the most, it's the moment right after Lucy has yanked that football away from Charlie Brown. He launches into the air, his nose to the sky. He utters one single word before crashing into the ground. Now, on paper, it's spelled all kinds of different ways, a mixture of A's and U's and H's, depending on the day that it happens. But the result always remains the same.
Ugh! Ugh! Ugh!
Eric Schulmiller is a cantor and a writer who's spent quite a bit of time dissecting the symbolism of that recurring moment, that tragedy for Charlie Brown. And he's been analyzing the many ways in which Lucy tricks her friend into running in for a kick year after year after year. He wrote about Charlie Brown's endless capacity to be deceived, and he's even researched the origins of that prank for Slate. And he joins me now. Eric Schulmiller, welcome.
Hi, Todd. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, how far back exactly does this football prank, this relationship between Charlie Brown and Lucy, go?
So if you're talking about the version that we're all familiar with, where Lucy yanks the ball away and poor trusting Charlie lands flat on his back, that version actually goes all the way back to 1953. But what I discovered when I was researching for this article is that there's actually a darker origin story that goes back even further.
Now, you figured out that, in fact, the first time Charlie got down to kicking the football, he was by himself and it didn't go well. And then he kind of lashed out.
Yeah. So if you look back at the original strip from the even earlier than 1953, you see an amazing image. And if you go to the Slate piece, you'll see images of all these different strips throughout the years. So there's an image of him trying to kick the football without anybody holding it. And he winds up flat on his back all on his own. And then in a strip a few days later, you see him try to kick and miss, and then it pans out, and you see these giant looming goalposts that completely dwarf him. It's a very dark image. And he feels humiliated. And in a strip less than a week later, Lucy tries to join the football game, and this is before the gag where she pulls the football has ever taken place, and she misses an attempt at kicking the football, and Charlie Brown humiliates her. He says, "Little girls don't belong on the football field. You should just get on out of here." And she leaves very dejectedly. And in my mind, in a way, this sort of plants the seeds for her anger, which leads to every single year tormenting Charlie Brown for maybe what was an original injustice years earlier.
Eric Schulmiller, we asked listeners about Peanuts and the plot lines and the characters, which ones sum up their worldview. We had a listener in Cocoa, Florida, who said the Chuck Lucy football gag did define them. You feel ahead financially in life, and then it dumps some sort of financial burden on you. And then from Portland, Oregon, we heard everybody knows the scene where after her promise to hold the football for Charlie Brown, Lucy pulls the football away just as Chuck runs up to it and falls flat on his back, but he continues to trust her. Sounds analogous to the American people's trust for our politicians. That came from Portland. What do you think?
I think that the Lucy football gag has become the go-to metaphor for our feelings of betrayal or disappointment when something doesn't work out our way.
And that sort of transcends a million different parts of life, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think we've all experienced that sense in every aspect of our life. And I think that the key for us, as for Charlie Brown, is to keep trying.
Eric Schulmiller, let me try out a fact on you before I let you go, because I'm not sure if you knew this. I didn't know this when I read this. March 30th. 1993. Do you know what happened on that date in the strip to Charlie Brown?
I don't.
Here's one. Charlie Brown hit a walk-off home run and won the game for the first time in his life that day. And then 3 months later, he did it again. He's done it twice. This is in real contrast, isn't it, to the football getting yanked away. The loser who gets his clothes knocked off on the pitcher's mound every other week actually hit two walk-off home runs.
I find that pretty surprising, considering that there was one strip late in the run where Lucy did let Charlie Brown kick the football without pulling it away. And of course, he wound up missing it anyway. So I guess I need to take another look at the baseball story instead of the football story.
Well, you might not be surprised then to know that later on it's revealed that Roxanne Hobbs, who is the pitcher for both of those home runs, she actually hung it over the plate and let him win. She felt bad for him.
Was she the redheaded girl?
No, she's not. She's a different girl. But even in success, Charlie Brown realizes it's not quite success, right?
Absolutely.
Eric Schulmiller is a cantor. He's a writer. As you know, he's been dissecting the Lucy and Charlie football dichotomy in Slate. Eric, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, Todd.
Well, whether you've spent time analyzing the intricacies of Peanuts or not, can you identify with any of the plot lines? Which Peanut character are you?
This is Mark. In Dallas, I most identify with Pigpen. In spite of all the grime and all the mess and maybe not so ideal of circumstances, I still have to find a way to shine and smile and contribute to the world in my own unique way.
This is Martin Labo-Kozer from Somerville, Massachusetts. I can identify closely with several Peanuts characters. Linus, the sensitive, geeky intellectual. Schroeder, who's focused on his art to the exclusion of all else. I'm a professional musician. Snoopy, the exuberant but impractical dreamer, and perhaps even Lucy. She has one good quality in among the abusive and sociopathic behaviors. She really doesn't care very much about anybody else's opinion.
Phoenix, Arizona says, Linus, the squiggles above his head describe my life. From South Carolina, my sister, a Peanuts fan for more than 55 years, says, I am Lucy, the big bossy sister. And from Gainesville, Georgia, Snoopy, because I've always dreamed of big adventures, and in the end, I'm sitting in my house. Doesn't Snoopy sit on his house?
That's Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway. The city of Scottsdale is hosting a first-of-its-kind event this weekend. Its downtown streets will be transformed into a modern-day version of a roaring 20s raceway, and attendees from across the valley will participate. KJZZ's Phil Latzman found out what it was all about.
Ladies and gentlemen, start your engines. This will be the sound and smell of Old Town Scottsdale this Saturday as the city hosts the Scottsdale Grand Prix, the inaugural race in the Vintage Mini Racing Series. The event is the brainchild of Napoleon Smith III, a TV and movie producer who thought the area would make the perfect backdrop for his idea.
We're creating a track right in the heart of Scottsdale. Most streets ever closed in Scottsdale, going over the waterfront bridge, going around where Nordstrom is, down Goldwater. We're passing about 20, 25 restaurants. Over 200 different businesses will be on the track.
Smith, who is executive producer of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles franchise, says he became fascinated with the mini racers and brought the idea to Scottsdale's mayor, Jim Lane.
I love Scottsdale. I went to school at University of Arizona, and this city I went to Mayor Lane. We went to him and we said, hey, we want to close off all your streets and do a mini race. And he said, all right, when are we doing our Grand Prix race?
A total of 40 different one-seat mini vintage race cars will careen through Old Town, each constructed to replicate roadsters straight out of the Roaring 20s. And they're all being built at a lighting factory in Mesa.
We have all our designing here in-house, and it goes right to the machines you see behind you, these laser cutters over here. And we can print out almost 90% of all the parts for this car are created right here in this facility.
The factory belongs to businessman Ron Kotloff, who until a year ago did not imagine he'd be building mini race cars. That was until Smith and organizers came to him with the idea.
Vintage cars have been around since the 1920s, and there's a community out there that builds these in their garage, but there's no manufacturing anywhere. So it was a perfect fit for the venue, and we decided to start designing them.
Kotloff says anyone was eligible to sign up and drive the racers, which are being built to fit the streets of Scottsdale and with safety in mind.
The course will be barriered, so every sidewalk will have a barrier, so there's no way a car could go into the crowd. And we have pretty great rules and a great race team that's put this together to make it safe.
The event is not only an auto race, it's a fashion show of sorts as well. Spectators are encouraged to show up wearing vintage 1920s garb and imagine they're in the streets of an exotic European country.
It's really meant to kind of look like the old Monaco-style Grand Prix where you're racing in front of the storefronts and the spectators are in the stores and sitting in front of the restaurants watching the race.
It's Jack G's job to design the open-air micro racers that will zoom through the streets of Old Town at speeds of up to 45 miles per hour.
Well, we're trying to capture the 1920s Grand Prix racer style, so the cars have to look cool.
Each of the cool vehicles is individually designed as what G and organizers call drivable pieces of art.
It's absolutely art, way beyond mini racers. They're true pieces of art that will be proudly displayed in places of businesses, and heck, these things are museum pieces as far as I'm concerned.
Nearby residents and businesses, though, shouldn't worry about their streets being taken over by a full-fledged car race. Scottsdale's Mayor Lane says it's mostly about the fun and pageantry of the event.
You could say it's far beyond a race, but in it being technical about it, it's hardly even a race. But it introduces a lot of people who might not otherwise be in downtown or even have an occasion to come to downtown, even with all the things that go on downtown. So we like to see these events that introduce people to our historic downtown.
Festivities begin in the early morning, and the 50-lap Grand Prix main event relay begins at 2 p.m. on Saturday. The race course measures just under a mile and will start and end on the Marshall Way Bridge at the Scottsdale waterfront.
That's KJZZ's Phil Lantzman, who is, without question, both the bee's knees and the cat's pajamas. Coming up on the show, German Shepherds are a popular police dog, but how are they at sniffing out clues?
There wasn't really a great olfactory basis or a great sort of study that said, this is the best nose, this is our best detector.
We find out who's the top dog at scent detection just ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 KJZZ. In Valley traffic, 101 northbound in the East Valley, three lanes blocked at Thomas Road. You want to avoid that area if you can. I-17 southbound, a collision blocking the intersection at Bethany Home. And on I-10 eastbound, a crash at Chandler Boulevard. Sunny skies this afternoon across the valley. Look for a high of 75 degrees. It'll be clear tonight with overnight lows near 50. A sunny and warmer weekend on the way as well. Look for highs of 80 degrees both tomorrow and Sunday. Right now in Phoenix, with sunny skies, it's 70 degrees at KJZZ at 2:35.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, announcing their seafood extravaganza with a selection of fresh seafood and shellfish flown in daily. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
In KJZZ News, Tempe Mayor Mark Mitchell will deliver his State of the City speech next week, and he says the state of Tempe is excellent.
Since I was elected mayor in 2012, we have announced over 16,000 new jobs and over $1 billion in capital investment. Tourism is strong, and we are one of the strongest tech markets in the state, and the future is bright here in Tempe.
Mitchell says his landlocked city is being creative and innovative in its growth, saying what was sustainable decades ago is not necessarily anymore. Mitchell, who also serves as president of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns, says Tempe has a great relationship with its neighbors.
By working together, we're attracting great companies to our valley, to our region. And one of the things I think that our competition is not so much the other cities around us. Our competition is Texas, Nevada, Colorado, New Mexico, California, and some overseas. That's our big competition.
Mitchell says the valley is a regional economy, so he's just as happy when employers locate to Phoenix or Chandler as he is when they come to Tempe. He says the entire region benefits by growing individual cities' economies. Mitchell will deliver his State of the City address Tuesday morning. We live in the era of big data, where information is collected on everything from medical care to public transportation, which hopes to create solutions to the problems we face. But being able to make sense of all that information is another problem altogether. That's why this week, the Imperial College in London opened Europe's largest data observatory, a room full of computers and monitors that transforms all kind of information into images. But what's the point? The BBC's Seema Kotecha went to take a look.
From the streets of London to the metro in Shanghai, this curved-shaped data observatory shows it all. It's made up of 64 monitors powered by 32 computers. Mark Kennedy is the director of the KPMG Centre for Advanced Business Analytics at the college here.
The value of being able to pull all the data together and visualize it is that you're able to work through problems that you haven't yet faced, see patterns that are going to happen, and prevent that problem.
Is it really worth millions of pounds?
Well, if it were only for that one thing, it probably would be, yes. But the fact that, this is just one of dozens and dozens of applications that we can tackle here is really a huge thing.
This Shanghai metro map projected behind me on all the screens shows the various transport lines weaving through parts of the city. And from looking at this, I'm told that researchers can know what to do if a line were to fail?
Probably partnerships between clinicians, informaticians, biologists, patient experts can also come
other
in here.
Other applications include a worldwide record of asthma patients, and the ability to see if a particular gene is more common in them. The designers say it will generate insights to help businesses improve their products and services and stay competitive. The audit and tax company KPMG has partly funded the observatory.
My name is Mazra Hussain. I'm a director within KPMG's digital analytics practice. The notion of a picture is 1,000 words, so essentially humans interact far better and are able to convey messages easier through visualizations. So being able to bring that data, visualize it, spot patterns, and identify opportunities for organizations is... it makes decision-making far easier for the executives that we work for and the organizations that we partner with.
The Chinese president saw the observatory during his visit last month. Here they say he was particularly impressed with the Shanghai Metro Data Bank. Researchers will also be using the observatory to investigate areas such as online fraud, climate change and the solar system. But there's a reluctance here to say how much it cost to build this enormous facility. Its effectiveness will be judged with time. Unsurprisingly, those at the launch have no doubt whatsoever that it will lead to answers to tough questions. Here's Mark Kennedy again.
This is big picture what-ifing.
So we're looking at a U-shaped
concoction
of 64 really, screens.
It's closer to a C, really. It's 315 degrees around, 64 46-inch monitors, 130 megapixels. So a lot of data.
That's the BBC's Seema Kotecha. Last week, many meat lovers felt singed by the World Health Organization's announcement that processed and red meats can cause cancer. Those foods join a long list of potentially cancer-causing foods. But what about someone who already has cancer? What should they eat? That varies widely depending on the cancer and the treatment. A Valley nonprofit called the Joy Bus cooks for cancer patients with that in mind. The show's Anika Klein took a ride to find out more.
The journey of a Joy Bus meal starts in a kitchen, which kitchen can change from week to week, since the Joy Bus doesn't have a permanent location. Today, it's Jennifer Caraway's kitchen.
Sauteed a little bit.
She's the founder of the nonprofit, which delivers freshly cooked meals once a week to some of the Valley's homebound cancer patients. More than half the food is donated.
We're just going to put together a little whole wheat linguine with some sautéed baby lobster tails and some Brussels sprouts and fresh tomatoes.
Caraway says she loves using tomatoes.
Just because of the lycopene in it, it's awesome for free radicals, give you the nice antioxidants.
Translation, tomatoes help fight cancer. What might be more important, though, is what Caraway doesn't put in the food.
Sugar. Never, ever, ever, ever do I use sugar. Ever. There's no need for it. There's so many awesome things out there that you can use to substitute.
Research shows weight gain from sugary foods can affect cancer outcomes. In fact, the whole food pyramid can get unstable for someone undergoing cancer treatment. Some things have to be taken out completely, like salt and other spices, because of how they react with the cancer, or even with the treatment. Caraway had to take out an ingredient many chefs swear by while cooking for a woman named Lisa.
Garlic. It made her ill. And she was an Italian lady who grew up eating garlic, like, daily.
In less than 15 minutes, we're ready to make a delivery. The lobster linguine is going to Marcus Klopaki. He's actually been doing really well, so he's technically not on the Joy Bus roster anymore, but Caraway is paying him a special visit today.
Knock, knock.
Hi.
Oh, hey. What's up, buddy?
Not much.
Marcus is 8, and he's excited about the gluten-free donut Caraway brought for dessert. He says he's discovered some of his favorite foods through the Joy Bus meals.
I really liked the sautéed potatoes. Those were really good. The shrimp, that was really good.
Marcus says his cancer made eating really tough.
I remember in kindergarten, after lunch we had recess, and I would have to like stay in to finish my lunch.
His mom, Melissa, says they stopped going to restaurants for the most part because they had to be wary of what Marcus ate. She says it was a huge help when Caraway started bringing restaurant-level meals to their home.
You look at it and it's just full of color. You can smell the aromas and you know it's healthy, which gives them huge energy.
For Caraway, the Joy Bus feeds her soul. She quit her job a few weeks ago to run the nonprofit full time. And as for the kitchen hopping, she's hoping that will change soon.
Right now, we are working on creating the Joy Bus Diner. And with that, we will have a kitchen to prepare all of our meals in, and it'll be a full-service diner open to the public.
Caraway signed a lease on a place this year.
We have to do it in order to grow. I mean, once we have a kitchen of our own, we can help quadruple the amount of people that we're helping right now.
She says the proceeds will help the organization become more sustainable, although she's still fundraising for the startup costs. And the menu will stay the same. Healthy options to help fight cancer, including lots of tomatoes. It's the show. I'm Anika Klein.
Battles were fought across the country during the U.S. Civil War more than 150 years ago. A few of those battles were fought here in Arizona. As a matter of fact, the Civil War conflict that was the farthest west was near Picacho Peak, the summit that's 50 miles north of Tucson. Did you know? Experts say it wasn't actually a battle. This is what happened when Union and Confederate soldiers came across each other near the peak in 1862.
Depending on whose historical documents you read, the Civil War battle at Picacho Peak happened on two different days. Union soldiers say it was on April 15, 1862. The Confederates say it was on April 16th. But historians say it took place on the 15th. Did you know that the battle was really not a battle?
No. No battle, no peak. Of the participants in the actual engagement on both sides would have been 23 soldiers.
That's Jay Van Orden, a retired Arizona Historical Society curator. He's also spent decades reenacting pivotal moments of the Old Southwest, including the Union and Confederate Civil War gunfight at Picacho Peak.
At most, it turned out to be a skirmish. It was never to happen. Neither side intended for anybody to shoot anybody.
Well, at least not until the California Union Cavalry reached Tucson. The volunteer army groups of several dozen soldiers were traveling 500 miles for a surprise attack on Confederate soldiers stationed in Tucson. The Union soldiers marched east from Yuma to Casa Grande on a route that today is Interstate 8. Lieutenant James Barrett led one of the two small groups sent to sweep for Confederate rebels.
Hold your fire.
As you hear in this reenactment video by the Arizona Historical Society, Barrett and his men stumbled upon 10 Confederate rebels lounging around a campsite. Without the rest of the cavalry, he and his small troop confronted the enemy.
For almost an hour, the Union and Confederate soldiers at the base of Picacho Peak played a cat-and-mouse game. They were taking pot shots at each other, firing and moving. And never really quite seeing their adversaries.
Andy Masek has written a book about the Picacho Peak encounter. He says when the rest of the cavalry arrived, Barrett and two of his men were dead. Others were injured. Barrett and the soldiers were buried near the scene, and the Union cavalry retreated. Years later, the two buried soldiers were reinterred in Tucson. Barrett's grave remained on the foothills of Picacho Peak. The grave marker deteriorated over the years, and Barrett's gravesite was lost. Again, Masek.
He was the first to die for the Union in Arizona. And that's one of the reasons I think that we do remember the skirmish at Picacho Pass.
About the Picacho name, Picacho in Spanish means high peak. So when we say Picacho Peak, we're actually saying Peak Peak. That's why experts often refer to it as Picacho Pass. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique or just know something that we should know, please tell us about it. The show at KJZZ.org. Good afternoon. This is the show. Happy Friday. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The show is bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. It's a service that blends everything that makes our world what it is. In Valley traffic on the 101 northbound in the East Valley, a collision at Thomas has three lanes blocked. You'll want to avoid that area. It seems pretty messy there. Elsewhere, I-17 southbound, a crash blocks the intersection at Bethany Home. And on I-10 eastbound, a collision at Chandler Boulevard. Look for sunny skies across the valley today with a high of 75 degrees. Clear skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows near 50. A sunny and warmer weekend on the way as well with highs right around 80 for both tomorrow and Sunday. More of the same on Monday. Around the state at this hour, it's 44 degrees in Flagstaff, 55 in Prescott, 47 at the Grand Canyon. It's 70 degrees in Tucson, 74 in Yuma. Here in Phoenix, with relative humidity of 18%, under sunny skies, it's 70 degrees at KJZZ at 251.
KJZZ is supported by Wells Fargo on behalf of Arizona Opera, performing Florencia en el Amazonas, an epic mystical journey down the Amazon River, inspired by Gabriel Garcia Marquez's magical realism, opening November 13th, azopera.org.
Dogs are known for their keen sense of smell. Research indicates a dog's snout could be more than 1,000 times more powerful than the human schnoz. But not all dogs are created equal. And as KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins sniffed out, one unlikely breed may be at the head of the pack.
The conventional wisdom is that hounds are the top dog when it comes to smelling. Their big noses and low-to-the-ground profile have made them the go-to breed for hunters for centuries. Yet German Shepherds are the dog most commonly employed by police and military forces around the world for search and rescue work as well as drug detection. But does their prolific use mean German Shepherds have the preeminent proboscis? Nathan Hall is a researcher at Arizona State University's Canine Science Collaboratory studying olfactory abilities in dogs. He says he couldn't find any scientific reason for using German Shepherds.
As far as I can tell, it's largely the choices have been historical. There wasn't really a great olfactory basis or a great sort of study that said, this is the best nose, this is our best detector.
So Hall decided to find out how German Shepherds' snouts stack up against the rest of the pack. To establish a baseline, he needed a breed of dog that wasn't known for their nose. Enter the pug. While pugs are bred and beloved for their companionship qualities, their respiratory capabilities leave something to be desired, or so it would seem.
They're brachycephalic, so pushed in faces, make those little snorting noises. So they snort a lot, they can have a lot of different sort of breathing problems. You know, a lot of times they're open mouth breathers.
So Hall set up a controlled scent detection experiment pitting the pug against the German Shepherd in his lab. The dogs were trained to find anise-flavored samples in a box of pine shavings, and the smart money was against the mouth-breathing pugs.
But then once they got up to actually doing the task, their mouths closed, and they started breathing really hard through their nose. It was a very clear switching on and off, so they were making very active sniffing responses.
And the results? The pugs dominated in every trial.
So we had 10 dogs in each group. And essentially, we had 9 out of the 10 pugs were at above 80% accuracy, and we did not see nearly the same amount for the German Shepherds. We had a couple of really good German Shepherds, but by far as a population, the German Shepherds were not up to par as the pugs were on the task.
Does this mean the pug will take the German Shepherd's place in the military and police forces around the world? Ryan Paschke is a canine handler with the Maricopa County Sheriff's Department, and his dog Yankee is a Dutch Shepherd. Paschke says while scent detection is important, an effective canine officer needs more than a good nose.
A lot of smaller dogs, they're not going to be able to reach the tops of dressers for the scent detection. We also use these guys for our patrol work. So if a bad guy runs from us, gets on top of a house, gets on top of a tall building, he could easily jump a 6-foot, 8-foot wall, no issues.
Paschke says the intimidation factor is also important.
They have a really mean, aggressive bark.
It's enough to make a suspect think twice about resisting arrest.
So just that alone, if they don't see the dog, they hear that bark, they'll come out of the house a lot quicker than they would without having them there.
While pugs may not be donning a badge just yet, Hall's research could lead to more opportunities for the pug. He says the USDA often uses beagles for customs work, and they're also employed by the TSA at airports.
Some situations, you want a really friendly-looking dog. If you want the dog to sniff, you know, people's luggage, if you want the dog to sniff around people, you want a dog that people are going to be comfortable around, that they can sort of just blend into the scene doing their work.
Hall hopes to continue his research with larger trials and more precise equipment to measure the still relatively unknown wonder that is a dog's nose. He says his research shows there's potential applications for all breeds and that, just as with people, we shouldn't make assumptions about a dog's capabilities.
Because maybe our assumptions are wrong.
Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You can hear more canine research experts tomorrow from ASU at its Going to the Dogs 2 presentation. We'll link to the event on our website at kjzz.org. Art can be about many things, including finding the beautiful in the mundane. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry finds that art can be as simple as just putting one foot in front of the other.
The Museum of Walking is tiny, real tiny, like so tiny that it's a tight squeeze to walk around the exhibit. Let me say that again. It was tough to walk in the Museum of Walking.
In a way, the Museum of Walking doesn't need a space. It's sort of a research center, and it is a place where discussion, many different discussions around walking are happening.
That's Angela Ellsworth, the co-founder and artistic director of the Museum of Walking. She sees walking as integral to her art and says that walking gives you a different view of the space you're in.
It's the experience in the body, and it's experiencing space in a new way. We can drive by certain shops or certain houses hundreds of times, and until we actually walk along that same route on foot, we don't see a lot that's there.
Which is why the small museum currently housed at ASU in Tempe goes outside of itself and has events all over town where people get together and walk.
I did an exercise with a group of people who were interested in walking, and they had to give me their cell phones. And I told them to leave the space where we were meeting and go walk for 1.5 hours away from that point. And they didn't have their cell phones. They had no GPS. They had no maps. They had no phone. They had no time. And it was interesting because one of the first questions was like, well, how am I supposed to know the time? How am I supposed to know how to get back in 1.5 hours? And I said, there are people in the world.
Ellsworth says that's one of the things that happens when people start to walk. They notice people and things they hadn't before, and especially in Phoenix, a city that's not particularly walkable. If you think about it, the concept is kind of old-fashioned, and the museum follows suit.
Our cataloging system happens on a Rolodex. Walking is analog. We like to think, of course, we could have a database, a digital database, but it's been interesting to go back to the analog. For instance, when you come to an opening, there's a sign on the door downstairs that has a phone number, a landline that you call. So whoever's in the museum has to walk down these steps, open the door for the visitor, and then come back up.
But it's that connection to the physical experience that makes walking so interesting and important. Ellsworth says that walking can be art, spiritual, or something else.
Political protests, marches, walking, that is all walking. Socioeconomically, who has to walk? Who walks for leisure or exercise? And then who actually, because they don't have a motor vehicle or other transportation, has to walk?
No matter what form it takes, for Ellsworth, a new perspective may just be a walk away.
Just the everyday that we see can be something completely mind-blowing and interesting.
They say life is about the journey, but sometimes it might just be a walk. Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News, Tempe. I'm walking, here's the knee, and I'm talking, but you and me, I'm hoping
that you come back to me. The
The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Virginia Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer, news director Al Macias, executive producer John Hoban. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. All Things Considered is next. It's 3 o'clock.